Shiva Krishna Padam Sayunala Mitashri Vishakam Vitascha Panchakabu Chikashaki Vasundi Vitapati Tanapa Vadiya Vashya Vidya Vodama. I don't know how this is supposed to go, but I can't get it. I can't get it to turn it off. It just goes on. Anyway. Whatever it is, it is. So it's May 10th, 2021, in Hillsborough, North Carolina, and we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 25, Text 4. Yatajirai karma mayai. Bhakti-vir-nama-nau-nibai. Vijyam anvikshikim hitva. Tidrik shanti bavarnavam. Yata.
Yata.
As. Adhidhai. Which are inadequate.
Karma mayai.
Based on fruit activity. Praktubihi.
By ritual
sacrifices. Nama. In name only. No nibai, which serve as boats, vijam, knowledge, andikshikim, spiritual, hitva, abandoning, titir shanti, they try to cross beyond, bala arnavam. The ocean of material existence.
The ocean of material existence.
DVT translation. This is Indra talking, giving his justification for why he has sent the Samvartika clouds of destruction. They're taking shelter of Krishna. It's just like the foolish attempt of men who abandon transcendental knowledge of the self and instead try to cross over the great ocean of material existence in the false boats of fruitive ritual sacrifices. That's very strange, because what he was upset about was that they didn't do their sacrifice for him. So let's look at what Srila Prabhupada says in Krishna book. Indra cursed the action of the inhabitants of Vrindavan and said, by defying the authority of the demigods, the inhabitants of Vrindavan will suffer in material existence. Having neglected the sacrifice to the demigods, they cannot cross over the impediments of the ocean of material existence. And we're going to look at the Tika of Jiva Goswami and Sanatana Goswami as identical. So we're just going to look at Jiva's, but they're identical. Just as foolish people trying to cross material existence by sacrifices which give temporary results, Adhirdai, the cowards took shelter of Krishna and offended me. This example shows that they acted unsuitably because of a lack of discrimination, or just as the foolish give up knowledge and try to cross existence by temporary sacrifices, the cowards gave up Indra's worship and took shelter of Krishna, and are trying to cross material existence. Because of his great anger, he did not complete the sentence. So that's interesting. So it's not a complete grammatical sentence. He was so angry, he just like, I'm going to stop in the middle. The real meaning, however, is this. So when Jiva is saying the real meaning, I just like you find our acharyas will often take things the demons say and turn them around to say the opposite of what the demons intended. So this is what he's saying. The real meaning, however, is this. Just as the devotees give up impersonal knowledge along with sacrifices and desire to cross existence simply by taking shelter of Krishna, the cowards gave up on worship and tried to cross material existence by taking shelter of him. So Jiva Goswami put a devotional spin on this. Having somehow the internet database is not behaving. meeting somewhat today. So the verse again, Yatab Jedi Kamamai Kratubir Namanoanibai Vidjam Anvik Shikim Hitva Titir Shanti Bhavarnava. They're taking shelter of Krishna. It's just like a foolish attempt of men who abandon transcendental knowledge of the self and instead try to cross over the great ocean of material existence in the false boats of fruitive ritual sacrifice. So the material life is often compared to an ocean. I mean, oceans are pretty. People like to go in the ocean, swim in the ocean, look at the ocean. Krishna says, a body of water, I am the ocean. He also says he is the Kratu, which is mentioned in this verse, that he is the ritual. But material nature being compared to an ocean means that if you're dropped off in the middle of the ocean without a boat, then you're dead. And you're going to suffer. And you're going to be struggling. Krishna uses the word parshati. So if you're just dumped in the middle of the ocean, you're going to be struggling. And how long can you just float? Even if you can just float, what will you drink? What is it? Water everywhere and not a drop to drink. So even if you could get, even if you'd be willing to eat fish or eat seaweed or something like that, you have nothing to drink. And so you're going to die. Or you'll be attacked by the various creatures in the ocean, the sharks, the jellyfish, and so forth. Prabhupada was telling me how she used to swim in the ocean in Hawaii, and you know, there were sometimes these big jellyfish, or these sea urchins, or all of these poisonous creatures that you have to be careful of. So the material world is like that. It's full of adhyatmic. And Prabhupada says in Kali Yuga, we're always attacked by at least one of them. Isn't that a fact? You know, our bodies are not working. Our minds are not working. The weather's bad. And other living entities are bothering us. And at least one of those is going on at every minute. Even if our body's healthy and no one's bothering us and it's a beautiful day, then our mind creates some unnecessary anxiety. Right? It's just, and then there's birth, death, old age, and disease. You have to be born, you don't know who you are, you can't talk, you're helpless, you can't control your body. Right? We get sick with various things, we get old, any of us who are getting old can tell you it's not a picnic. And then, you know, everything that you've worked for your whole life, just taken away to death. Your education, your money, your family relationships, your friendly relationships, your career, your possessions, your whole mundane identity just gone. So it's an ocean. It's a great ocean. And if you want to be safe in an ocean, you need a boat. Or a helicopter. You know, so we have those pictures of a Krishna coming on Garuda and pulling the devotee out of the material ocean. So, transcendental helicopter, Garuda. But generally you need a boat to cross the ocean. So here Indra is saying they're in the wrong boat. This boat isn't going to work. So I thought we'd look at boats in Shastra and what type of boats there are. And then we're going to look at the nature of Indra's statement and the fact that it's in the Bhagavatam and how do we understand such statements in the Bhagavatam. So, types of boats. So, the human body is considered a boat for crossing the material ocean. These are all boats that could be used to cross the material ocean. What kind of boat are you going to use? And just like if you drop off in the middle of the Atlantic or the Pacific, there's all different kinds of boats that could take you across, right? Isn't it? You could even go on a submarine. The Navy knew that you were there, they could pop up from there off the radar submarine and carry you that way. And there are sailing vessels that used to go across the... Sometimes people go in a little sailing vessel. And some big cruise ship, or maybe a cargo boat. So the different boats that can take us across the material ocean. So one of them is our body. The human body is said to be, in the Shastra, in 11:20:17, the boat for crossing the ocean. Does anyone know the rest of that allegory? The human body is the boat, and who's the captain? The
guru.
The guru. And the winds?
The Vedas.
The Vedas, yes, Shastra. All right, and we also have sometimes the mind is the boat.
The what?
Mind. The subtle body. But this is usually considered to be a bad boat. So, like, if you think the mind is a boat, you're probably in trouble. And Krishna in Bhagavad Gita 2:67 said, if you're in the boat of the mind, then any wind can knock you off course. And he's talking about the winds of sense attraction. So if you get attracted to any of the senses, even smell or, you know, anything, hearing, it can act as a wind and knock this boat off course. Indra, interestingly enough, after he offends his guru, and this, of course, is related to also body as boat, he says that if you offend your guru, your pride will make your boat into stone. He says this in Bhagavatam 6:7:14. So we might say, I have a great human body and a human mind, but the captain is the guru. So if you offend your guru, then your boat becomes like stone, it just sinks. In 10:87:33, the personified Vedas just say, if you don't have a guru, you don't sink, but you don't go to land, because nobody can steer your boat. All right, then we have sacrifice as a boat. Now, Indra here, ironically and kind of crazily, is criticizing Kratu. He's saying this Kratu, this ritual, is a bad boat. He doesn't actually use the word stone, but this is in the BPT translation. It's a bad boat, Kratu. And this, to me, doesn't make sense because the cowards simply switch the object of their Kratu from Indra to Govardhana. So if Kratu in general is a bad boat, then why does Indra not want them to do his Kratu? You know, it's not really the Kratu, it's not the ritual, it's the object of the ritual that he's upset about. You're not doing your rituals for me. A Kratu, again, it's a particular part of a yajna. Krishna says that he's the Kratu and he's the yajna in the Bhagavad Gita. So, like, let's say I want to call you on the phone. So there's a ritual I have to do. I have to have a work with the phone, right? The battery has to be charged. It has to be connected to the network. You need to have a phone with the battery charged and connected to the network. I have to call you at a time that you're going to be awake and near your phone, and I have to put in the right number. If I get one number off, I don't get you. That's a crutch. It's a ritual. Does that make sense to everybody? So let's say, instead of calling you, I call somebody else. That's what Indra's objecting to. Instead of them calling him, they call Govardhana. And he's saying, why are they in this boat of rituals? But he wasn't really objecting to ritual. He was just objecting that they called somebody else. They were directing it to someone else. And interestingly enough, Krishna identifies ritual and sacrifice as a boat for crossing the material ocean. In 11:6:37, when he's telling the Yadus to go to Prabhaskshetra. So then he says, by going to a holy place like Prabhaskshetra, performing the rituals of sacrifice and giving in charity, that will act as a boat to take you over the material life. And in fact, you know, we're not opposed. We do so many rituals, don't we? Yes? We do so many transcendental rituals. So many transcendental sacrifices. Kratus and yajnas, or japa is a yajna, right? Sankirtan is a yajna, or worship of the deities is also a kratu and yajna. Then we have the boat of transcendental knowledge. Now, Indra's referring to that as the proper boat here. He's saying they should have taken up the boat of transcendental knowledge instead of the boat of ritual, which again makes no sense in this context. He's so angry that he's just kind of speaking something a little bewildering. So transcendental knowledge, of course, Krishna in Bhagavad Gita 4.36 says one can cross over all the ocean of material miseries in the boat of transcendental knowledge. And again, in today's verse, Indra says that's the real boat. Lord Shiva, in his prayers to the gifts of the Prachetas in 4.24.74, says transcendental knowledge is the only boat, the only one that works, to take you over the ocean of material miseries. And in 9.8.13, Lord Kapila, the Sankhya philosophy, is said again to be the only boat, transcendental knowledge. And in a similar sense, the Avanti Brahman in 11.23.29 says detachment is the only boat. All right, then we have some statements about that chanting the holy names is the only boat, and that attraction to Krishna is the only boat. So in 1.6.34, it stated that chanting the holy name is the only boat to get relief from anxieties. And in 12.4.40, that a taste for chanting and a taste for Krishna is the only boat. And then, of course, we have that Krishna is the only boat, which is what Indra is objecting to here. Why are you getting in the Krishna boat? Why aren't you getting in my boat? You're in the wrong boat, he's saying. So that Krishna is the only boat. So this is said by Narada in 11.5.33. It's said in 10.1.5 about Arjuna, that Arjuna crossed over the ocean, not of material existence, but of the battle of Kurukshetra, by having Krishna as his boat. Prithvi Maharaj in 4.2.39 says Krishna is the only boat. In 8.17.28, the Devas say that Krishna is the only boat. But my favorite Krishna is the only boat quotes come from 10.2.30 and 10.14.58. So in 10.2.30, the demigods are praying to Krishna in the womb. And they say, my dear Lord, your lotus feet are the only boat to get across the ocean of material existence. And the saintly persons get in that boat. But if they get in that boat and cross the ocean, the boat should end up on the other side of the ocean. But we see it stays here. So how is that? How is it that the boat doesn't move?
It stays here because when the great devotees leave this world, when they become Arpaka, they leave the boat there for others to cross over.
Yes, that is one of the answers, that when the devotees leave, they leave the opportunity of Krishna to speak for others. What's another answer?
The water in the ocean shrinks to live with that.
The water in the ocean shrinks to how big?
The water in the footprint of a calf.
The water in the footprint of a calf. So we don't see a lot of calves running around and running around here in Goloka. So that analogy, like, what? But if we think about maybe a big dog, or a deer, there are deer around here. So a big dog or a deer, so imagine you're really muddy ground and you see some of the footprints of a deer or the paw prints of a big dog in muddy ground and it rains and that little print fills up with water. So how much water is that? A little bit. Couple tablespoons, maybe?
No,
it's not even a big cup. Maybe a fourth of a cup, maybe. So maybe an eighth of a cup. So the whole Pacific Ocean, or the whole Atlantic Ocean, becomes a couple of tablespoons. And the demigods say, you don't even have to get in the boat. This always struck me. You just go close to it. So you just walk toward the boat. And then all of a sudden, the Pacific Ocean shrinks down to 2 tablespoons. And you walk over it without even noticing that you've walked over it. Now, Lord Brahma says practically the same thing in 10.14.58. He says that Krishna is the boat, and when you approach Krishna, the whole ocean becomes, again, in the footprint of a calf, it becomes nothing. And I think we've experienced this to a large extent, maybe not completely, but we've experienced that when we take shelter of Krishna, that our material problems become insignificant. Yes, has everyone experienced this? When we don't take shelter of Krishna, our material problems seem completely insurmountable. And they are. They are. Krishna tells us they are. We look at our material problems and we see the Pacific Ocean. And even a small place like Lake St. Clair in Michigan is really big. Or Lake Superior, when to speak of the ocean, with Mediterranean, you know, other big bodies of water, I mean by the Black Sea, the Caspian Sea, they're huge. What to speak of the Pacific? If you've flown over the Pacific, you're flying over the Pacific for a long time. And that's fine. It's insurmountable. But when we think about Krishna, it somehow just vanishes. Have we experienced this? If we get absorbed, actually absorbed, that's why these votes are also the chanting and the absorption. We get absorbed in that. There is no more material ocean. It's gone. It's just gone. So all of these are true. The human body is the boat. If you have the right captain, you have to be careful of being swept away by the pride. The proper prabhu and the proper yajna, when done for Krishna, are the right boat. Transcendental knowledge about Krishna is the boat. Chanting and attraction for Krishna is the boat. And Krishna himself is the boat. That's all true. And of course, Krishna consciousness includes all of that. If I have got Krishna as my boat, then my taste for chanting is included. My rituals and sacrifices to please Krishna are included. Using my human body in his service is included. Making sure I have a proper guru is included. Transcendental knowledge and detachment are included. All right, let's look for a minute at Indra's statement here, because Indra's statement, superficially, is it true or not? Well, it's true the way Jiva and Sanatana termed it, but as Indra said it, is it true?
Incorrect, because he's not that position. That's not his position to say that.
Okay.
Well, he's contradicting himself.
Yeah.
He is definitely contradicting himself. He's so angry. Have you ever been so angry or seen someone so angry that they said totally something ridiculous? Right? At least if we haven't done it, we've heard somebody do it. Somebody gets so angry, and maybe we got that angry, that we say something ridiculous that even contradicts our own position. Yes, has everyone experienced that? Somebody in anger? They say something and you're like, I don't think you have to say that.
Say what?
They say the opposite of what they would mean. Someone in anger may say something that doesn't, that actually supports the opposite position. Yes? Yeah, maybe we've done that?
Uh-huh.
Say something in anger and someone looks at us and says, did you mean to say that? Hi, Krishna. So we have a situation that such statements are in the Bhagavata, they're in the Shastra, and we have the instruction given by Srila Prabhupada that any word of the Shastra is purifying. Yes? We have Bhagavatam's own statement that it throws out Kaitava Dharma, that there's nothing cheating in the Bhagavatam. And we have this term that Prabhupada gave to Bhagavad Gita as it is. Now, many times devotees take such statements to mean that anything stated in the Bhagavatam or the Bhagavad Gita is absolute, universal, eternal, non-contextual truth. You know, in the Chakrasloki of the Bhagavatam, Krishna talks about this. He said in the last verse that this is true in all times and all places and for all people. So what we call truth that is true everywhere, material world, the spiritual world, at all times, it's true in Satya Yuga, it's true in Treta Yuga, it's true in Dwapara Yuga, it's true in Kali Yuga, it's true when the material world is manifest, it's true when the material world is not manifest, and it's true for all people. It's true for all demigods. It's true for all animals. It's true for all trees. It's always true in every circumstance, for everyone, in all places, and in all time. So we call those kind of truths Siddhanta. Now, Siddhanta can also be ordinary, like we have a debate, and the conclusion of the debate can also be called a Siddhanta. Siddhanta can mean any ordinary conclusion. If you say, are we going to go to Poets Walk or River Walk? And you decide that you're going to go to River Walk, that's your Siddhanta, that's your conclusion. So in an ordinary sense, Siddhanta can mean just, do I decide to wear a green shirt or a purple shirt? Do I decide to make pakoras or kofta? It can mean like that. But when we're talking about the Siddhanta of our tradition, we're talking about statements that are true everywhere, at every time, for everyone. And one of the hermeneutical ways in which we understand Shastra is we take a statement from the Shastra and we compare it to Siddhanta. And we have four options. One, the statement in Shastra is a restatement of Siddhanta. Two, the statement in Shastra is a statement of Siddhanta, but it's applied in a particular time, place, and circumstance. Number three, it's not a statement of Siddhanta at all, but it's something that supports Siddhanta. Number four, it's a statement that apparently opposes Siddhanta. Now, there's a way that opposing statements ultimately support Siddhanta, but you have to do some explanation, as Jiva and Siddhanta Goswami do, in order for that to happen. On the face of the statement, it opposes Siddhanta. So let's look at what we mean by our Gaudiya Siddhanta. Now, our Gaudiya Siddhanta is not going to be worded exactly the same as would be by the followers of Madhva, or by the followers of Ramanuja, or by the Christians, or by the Muslims. Even though we're talking about universal, eternal, transcontextual truth, different traditions are going to use somewhat different language. So, Madhvacharya's main disciple, Vyasatirtha, compiled a list of 10 universal, eternal, transcontextual, applied to everybody, all the time, in all places, truths. Baladeva Vibhushana, who had been a follower of Madhya and became particularly a follower of Lord Chaitanya, and established that the Gaudiya Sampradaya is a bona fide Sampradaya, took these 10 truths written by Vyasatirtha and changed the language somewhat to make them very specific for the followers of Lord Chaitanya. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakura then took this list of 10 truths from Baladeva Vibhushana and also compiled it and changed the language somewhat, and wrote a whole explanation called the Dasmula Tattva. So these are: the statements of Amnaya, that's of the Shastra of the Bhagavatam, are the chief proof. By these statements, the following 9 topics are taught. Krishna is the supreme absolute truth. Krishna is endowed with all energies. Krishna is the ocean of rasa. The jivas are all separated parts of the Lord. In bound state, the jivas are under the influence of matter due to their chitasta nature. In the liberated state, the jivas are free from the influence of matter due to their chitasta nature. The jivas and the material world are both different from and identical to the Lord. Pure devotion is the practice of the jivas. Pure love of Krishna is the goal. So, Devendra's statement, was that a repetition of any of these? Indra's statement, was that a restatement of any of these? Again, his statement, Their taking shelter of Krishna is just like the foolish attempt of men who abandon transcendental knowledge of the self and instead try to cross over the great ocean of material existence in the false boats of fruitive ritual sacrifice. Was that a statement of universal, eternal, transcendental truth? No. Was it taking a statement of universal truth and applying it in a particular situation? You say yes? Which statement of truth would have been applied? None of them. Was it supporting Siddhanta?
No.
No. It was opposing. In your statement was saying that service to Krishna, which is statement number 9, pure devotion is the practice of the jivas, is wrong. He was saying pure devotion to Krishna is just a materialistic ritual. Isn't that an offense on chanting? To compare devotion to Krishna to some materialistic ritual? So why is there a statement opposing Siddhanta in Bhagavatam?
Because it's related to the person of Indra who was opposed. I mean, like, it's part of the story.
Yes, it's part of the story. In the story, we have somebody who's opposed. And in order to present the Siddhanta of taking shelter of Krishna and the pure devotion as the goal, the opposing element also is presented. Therefore, taken as a whole, does it support Siddhanta?
Yes.
But taken in isolation, it opposes Siddhanta. Does this make sense to everybody? Like the Rani Kashipu, you know, ranting against Vishnu. You know, these statements of the demons, they oppose Siddhanta. Now, our Acharyas like to play with these statements and say, because they don't like to hear anything opposing Siddhanta, and neither do we. But it's in the Bhagavatam, so we're chanting the world, singing the Sanskrit. We're all singing. Don't take shelter of Krishna, it's not a good hope for taking over the ocean. We're all seeing that. You know, so the Acharyas are saying, if we're going to go around singing these verses, let's try to understand them differently. Let's try to get an opposite meaning than the meaning of that was intended by the speaker. Correct? But Shishupala says, you're the lowest. And the Acharya say, well, that means he's the highest, that he pushes everybody else down. Because otherwise, how are we going to chant these verses? It would just be, like, painful. We're told if we are blasphemy of the Lord that we're supposed to leave or kill ourselves even. Don't do that, please. That's what we're told. Better to die, better to leave. Not only are we hearing it, we're chanting it. Right? We're talking about it. So, therefore, as I say, the Acharyas turn around those verses. But if we look at those verses in isolation, they're opposed to sin. And very interesting, this is a true story. One time when I was preaching in India, one gentleman came up with me and said, yes, I always follow Bhagavad Gita. I said, oh, that's very nice. He said, you know that verse when Krishna says to Arjuna, now you do it to everybody. He says, so this is the motto of my life. I mean, whatever my life. So, this is the problem. If someone thinks understanding Shastra as it is means that I can take something out of its context and I can apply it literally. So if we take this one verse out of the story, and we just look at the literal meaning, then we're going to have something in opposition to Siddhanta. So therefore, Therefore, it's very good for us to learn what are our ancient Vedic and Vaishnava techniques to understand the meaning of Shastra. Otherwise, we may get in the wrong boat. So questions, comments, additions, subtractions? Yes.
Instance, it's very, you know, obvious what the situation is, but that we have to really be attuned because there are circumstances that can be much more subtle. And one thing that also someone had brought up yesterday I was listening to was that even, for instance, when someone is transcribing, for instance, Prabhupada's or editing Prabhupada's books. I'm not bringing up that whole editing thing, but it can be with anyone, whether it's with Prabhupada or any other person, where you put a comma in a sentence, or where you put, you know, a different symbol can affect how you read what the topic is. So I think this point of hermeneutics that you're stressing is really, really important, that you don't just focus on one particular
sentence. Yes, yes. So Krishna Priya is saying how that today's example may be obvious, at least to us, but there are other subtle examples, and even if someone's editing or transcribing, where you put a comma changes the meaning, right? Like, is it, it's time to eat, children, or it's time to be children. Yes. So, yes, just...
I think in cases when people selectively choose, you know, quotes from Shastra, it's always because they're self-serving. In other words, they're not looking for truth, they're looking to support a personal point.
Mm.
And so therefore, in some ways, you may not be able to analyze everything perfectly through hermeneutics, but you know that a person making a point to support just a personal issue. And therefore, it's
voted. Well, it's not just we're saying people will choose selectively to support a personal issue, but a big part of hermeneutics is looking at your own biases.
Yeah.
And it's a huge part of hermeneutics is looking at what are my own qualities, what's my own sadhana, what's my own biases, you know, am I open to transformation, am I studying holistically? So that is also included. In order to mitigate against this tendency that I'm just going to selectively quote, the Christians say, Prabhupada would quote, that the devil can cite Shastra.
Yeah, it's the same as Prabhupada says, you know, or Prabhupada said, that, you know, we use that statement all the
yes,
time.
Yes, Prabhupada says, if you can just
take out of context.
Exactly.
Prabhupada said, I can do what I want.
Absolutely.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Prabhupada ki jai.